The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
Ashes to Ashes. In this five-part series from The Telegraph, we remember five iconic Ashes tests. Two rival players who took centre stage will relive their roles in one of the longest-running duels in sporting history. Ashes to Ashes, Edgbaston 1981, with John Embury.
Ian then, all of a sudden, he started to run in harder. He bowled, and although it wasn't a quick pitch, he hit the pitch hard. He bowled full, and he bowled straight, and all of a sudden, he got a breakthrough, and then another breakthrough, and then another breakthrough.
And Terry Alderman.
There was no cockiness in the dressing room. It was everyone, you know, trying to make the effort to get these runs, and maybe that was it. You know, we were too wound up.
That's it this time. He's made sure he's taken five wickets. He grabs a stump, and another memorable victory for England.
Shil Berry, The Telegraph's cricket correspondent.
The miracle happened at Headingley earlier in the series. Why should there be another? Yet lightning struck for the second time in consecutive tests. It was a Sunday afternoon, and the Edgbaston crowd, for all the fervent patriotism in the Hollies stand, fell silent. England were going to lose and go 2-1 down. Now Australia needed less than 50 to win, with 6 wickets left. But Brearley and Botham were not done yet. For a final fling, Botham bowled from the city end. And suddenly the chemistry was right. He took a wicket. The Hollies stand caught fire. The Australians took flight, hounded by Botham like an Alsatian chasing sheep. He took 5 wickets for 1 run. England went 2-1 up, not down.
Ashes to Ashes. Paul Hayward, Telegraph chief sports writer.
In the late 1970s, England's international opponents were weakened by the exodus of players to the World Series. There were wins against New Zealand, Pakistan and Australia before the status quo returned in 1979, and international teams were once again at full strength. Midway through 1980, Ian Botham replaced Mike Brearley as England captain. Here's John Embury.
The England cricket team were on a bit of a downer after the winter in the Caribbean under the leadership of Ian Botham. And, you know, we've got a lot of criticism in terms of the way we played. We had issues all the way through with Ian's leadership. We didn't play particularly well, and we never did against the West Indies because they were such a good side. Our batting struggled against them. Our lower order certainly weren't going to score any runs against them. And Ian felt the weight of that as well. And his own performances, which was quite exceptional against everybody else, wasn't against the West Indies. I think that was felt by the players as well, that we didn't have the Ian Botham that we needed against the West Indies because they were such a good side. There was a lot of uncertainty of the direction that the team were going. Having struggled in that series, obviously we came home and we had the Australian series to play in 1981, and everyone was looking forward to that and hopefully a change of fortunes.
There was always plenty of interest with an Ashes series. It was my first tour, so first time I'd ever played for Australia and been picked. The team that went to England in 81 was one of the first teams back together again after Kerry Packer's World Series. So there was a bit of people finding their feet back again and me just finding my feet at test level. So being on a tour for 6 months to the UK was a big thing for me. And Australia had been beaten in the previous Ashes series, of course, in Australia while the World Series cricket was going on. So that caused a bit of angst.
World Series cricket had seen Australian media tycoon Kerry Packer set up a breakaway international series for his Channel 9 TV network. It was created against a backdrop of poor pay and Packer's desire to secure exclusive rights to international cricket. Almost all the big names had signed up. Here's Terry Alderman.
The players were very unhappy. There were times there, would you believe, a gate man was getting paid more than the players were at the MCG. We found that out one day, in a one-day international. And there were 75,000 people there. So there was all sorts of angst by the players. They knew that the money was still rolling in for advertising, crowds. The players thought that they should have been getting a share of it. Some of the games weren't that well attended. So it was two separate breakaway groups. You know, obviously the Nine Network was showing World Series games, and then I think it was probably the ABC, the Australian broadcaster, was doing the test matches. It created a fair bit of confusion, I suppose, for the public. So it was a huge thing. I just sat back and still played my club cricket and a little bit of cricket for Western Australia while it all went on, and then got picked for that 81 tour. Well, we always got the usual. We were the worst team to leave the shores, you know, of Australia and all that sort of stuff, and Dennis Lilly was too old and Rod Marsh was getting on, and all of those sorts of things were being mentioned. I turned 25 on the tour, so I'd played my first game for Western Australia when I was 18, so I'd done a good 6 or 7 years apprenticeship, and when I was picked in place of Geoffrey Robert Thompson, and boy, did I cop it from Tomo in the press. What's this young upstart getting a game? He's not a quick bowler and all this sort of stuff. So, yeah, certainly there were a lot of accolades for people, and I was a school teacher at the time, and they got the whole school around me for photos and things like that.
Both sides shared the spoils in the one-day internationals before the test series began. It didn't start well for England.
We weren't to envisage losing the first test against Australia at Trent Bridge. One or two changes in selection, and then at Lord's in the second test match. But things didn't work well for Ian. He got a pair in the match. There was rumours that the chairman of selectors was going to sack him. Ian got wind of that and resigned before the inevitable happened. And then Mike Brearley came back, and we needed strong leadership in those situations. And we may not have had that with Ian, to be honest with you. But as soon as he decided to resign after that second match against Australia at Lord's, you know, the shackles came off, and Ian went to Headingley, and he had to go out. He felt that he had to go out there and prove to everyone that he was going to become a great player, but most importantly, a match-winning player for England with bat and ball.
Against the dismal backdrop of the first two tests, England's performance at Headingley goes down in history as one of the best. 227 runs behind Australia, they followed on. The visitors were on the verge of wrapping up an easy win to go 2-0 up in the series.
We were cock-a-hoop. We thought the game was all over, and we saw the 500-1 bet come up on the electronic scoreboard. Godfrey Evans, he was working for Ladbrokes at the time, and that was the first time there'd been ever an electronic scoreboard, I believe, at a UK ground. So we were there having our afternoon tea and looked over miles ahead in the game, and we see 500-1. And I think it was Dennis said, 500-1, you'd have to have a quid on that, wouldn't you? You know, as we were having a bit of a joke. And he ended up giving our bus driver, the Geese, as he was called, a tenner to take over to Ladbroke's tent. And he was going around. As we were walking out, you could see the bus driver was going around over to the tent, and Rod Marsh whistled him and said, "Hey, Geese, put £5 on for me." So 10 for Dennis and 5 for Rod. We didn't even think about that bet until the disaster of us getting knocked over.
Up stepped Botham with a gung-ho 149, forcing Australia to bat again. And an inspired Bob Willis swept through their lineup with 8 for 43, sealing a remarkable 18-run win.
It wasn't until the game was over and everyone was so gloomy, and I think I can't even remember who said it. It might have even been me. I don't know. I said, "What about that bet?" And you know, it certainly stirred us out of the gloom a little bit. It was always going to be Ian Botham's test match at Headingley. He'd been the hero, hadn't he? And really, when you think about it, leading up to the Headingley Test match, Ian Botham was replaced as captain by the doctor, Mike Brearley. So he was one step away. If he had, say, failed at Headingley, and if he had had enough failure at Edgbaston, you know, there was talk of Ian Botham going out of the side.
Ashes to ashes.
Botham and Willis had been engaged in a standoff with the media. Brearley had spent valuable pre-match time trying to patch things over.
Well, I think at that time, Ian had a contract with one of the tabloid newspapers. And of course, when you've got competition between the newspapers, whatever Ian was doing for one newspaper, he wouldn't do interviews with the other. So it became a little bit of a war. So where he was again promoted with one paper through his performances, the other paper was very critical of him. So the players were in the middle of this, and the players felt that there was just that little bit of change in the media over this sort of squabble over Ian. It was like going into a test match with 12 players as opposed to 11, because he could make match-winning performances with the bat and he could make match-winning performances with the ball. Ian only had to have a bad game, and there was negative criticism of Ian. But that affected the whole team, because it was a criticism of the whole England team, not just Ian. And you do end up having this siege mentality, which actually detracts from what you're trying to achieve on the cricket field.
The Headingley win was quite a diversion for a country marred by inner-city riots and industrial unrest. The day before the fourth test at Edgbaston, Charles, Prince of Wales, married Lady Diana Spencer.
Everyone saw it because it was on every TV station, and every time you turned around, there was the wedding. It was in our minds, I suppose, in a way. It was a thrill. We'd met the Queen at Lord's, the previous test match, so we'd had a bit of the royalty there, and Mum still had the photo at home after I'd been presented to the Queen, as the players were on the ground at Lord's. So she was very thrilled, my mum, the fact that I'd met the Queen.
Everyone knows how well or what a successful sporting side can do in terms of lifting the country. So the performance at Headingley was a fantastic thing for the England cricket team, but not just them. In the way that the game unfolded, it was a great thing for people in the country. And all of a sudden, it sort of promoted the on the front pages of the newspapers about the Headingley performance, which was a great thing because it was just a spark of life and it just lifted everyone and just took a little bit of pressure off of a lot of people.
Graham Dilley had been crucial in Botham's 149 at Headingley, but he was dropped for Edgbaston. The man who would replace him? John Embery.
Graham Dilley, he was a quick bowler. You know, it was a bit of a shock, but for John Embery to come in on that turning, on a turning Edgbaston wicket, I think everyone thought that, you know, the spinners had to play a part in that. And even, you know, Embers had a bit of success. Our left-arm spinner in Ray Bright had some success as well. So, yeah, it wasn't, it was a bit of a shock, the fact that he was a hero at Headingley one day and then the next day he's out of it.
You know, you just want to play. You don't want to get a tap on the shoulder at 11 o'clock on the Thursday morning from the captain to say, look, we're not going to play here today. We don't feel the conditions are going to be suitable for your style of bowling. The pitch looked as though it was going to be slow. It certainly wasn't going to be bouncy. And it was a sort of pitch that you felt was going to be a little bit attritional, and you felt that might get a little bit lower as the match went on. And that was the case.
England posted a first innings total of 189. Terry Alderman had continued the strong start to his international test career, with figures of 5 for 42.
Nice, comfortable run up there. And that's Edge, and it's beautifully taken by Rod Marsh to end that last wicket stand. Bob Willis goes for 13. England all out for 189, and applause not only there for Rod Marsh, but for bowler Terry Alderman. That means it's 5 wickets again in a test match for him.
At the end of that first day, it was a huge disappointment that we'd only got 189. And it was more through poor shot selection and execution rather than playing with gay abandon and getting out. It was a tricky pitch to play on. Nobody scored 50 in the game, and batting was hard work. The ball wasn't coming onto the bat. You had to pitch the ball up. Anything short, you would concede runs. And everyone struggled.
Well, you know, there's times when you think, well, you're bowling at the other end of the great Dennis Lilly. Well, maybe, you know, the rubbing off of them, you know, letting their guard down a little bit against Dennis, because, you know, he was a ferocious opponent till the end of his career. So, you know, there's always that thought that it rubbed off on me at the other end. They let their guard down a little bit against me. No one had really seen me. I hadn't played county cricket or anything like that. But I think though that wicket bit was a bit slow and it just nipped around a little bit for me. That's what I remember about it. You know, just getting the ball to move a little bit more, and Dennis maybe have been banging the ball in.
We went out at the end of that evening. I think we got a couple of early wickets. And I do remember Kim Hughes got some runs. I think he got 40 or 47. And all of a sudden, having taken a couple of wickets, the Australians developed a mini partnership. And I think they were 5 wickets down when they went past our total. And then the partnership between Hughes and Martin Kemp, we got Hughes out. And then all of a sudden, we just whittled away the last 5 wickets to bowl the Australians out, for them to have a lead of, I think, somewhere around about 69. And we were back in the game.
Australia, all out for 258, held the advantage. Embury had proved useful with figures of 4 for 43.
My strength as a bowler was I had good control over line length, and I preferred a pitch that had bounce in it. And it was the ideal wicket for me to bowl on because the ball wasn't coming on. The batsmen were feeling for the ball, and I bowled a very good control. And I think that's probably one reason why Mike Brearley selected me at the beginning of that game, because he knew that he had someone that could give him that control in that situation. If he wanted someone to bowl, he knew that I wasn't going to get smashed around for 3-4 runs and over. You know, forced the Australians really into playing some poor shots and picked up those 4 wickets in the middle of the innings, which just sort of undermined the Australians when they were getting into a position of dominating. And then the seamers came back on at the end of the innings and picked up the last 3 or 4 wickets.
We were ahead of the game after the first innings. I think we probably should have got a few more runs than we did, and the lead should have been a little bit more. And then England, their tail wagged again. Bob Taylor and John Embry and Chris Auld, I think, got some runs.
In England's second innings, they were only 98 runs ahead when Embury was sent out to bat after tea on day 3.
I can't remember being told to go out and attack after tea, when we were sort of 6-7 wickets down. And I just went out there to play and do my job and try and develop a partnership with someone. And I was a very unorthodox batsman. I didn't have much of a backlift. I used to shovel everything on the leg side. I had very few shots on the offside, and my strongest shot was the cut shot. So I sort of nudged and nurdled my way through and picked up the odd boundary, and really just tried to survive. It was the seam bowlers that I had more difficulty with, Terry Alderman in particular, that bowled a good length, and Liney bowled a foolish length and got you feeling for the ball. Rodney Hogg was obviously quick and made the ball skid on, which actually was on that pitch was a little bit easier to play. And the same with Dennis Lilly as well. You know, he was very, very aggressive, but the sting was taken out by the pitch from his game. And it became a very attritional game. But, you know, I managed to pick up a few boundaries, and we managed to develop a partnership, Bob Taylor and myself. And all of a sudden, we felt the score creeping up. And as it was creeping up, and we got it to a lead of 149, and then Bob got out, Bob Willis came in, scored 2, and then we were all out. Australia had to get 151. But when we came off the field, though we were down, we just felt that we'd gotten ourselves out of a little bit of trouble because of the partnership, and that there was a little bit of belief that we could actually win the game.
There was no cockiness in the dressing room. It was everyone, you know, trying to make the effort to get these runs, and maybe that was it. You know, we were too wound up with, you know, the thought of another Headingley happening. We lost some early wickets on the previous night, and then there was that little, I think it was a good little mid-partnership the next day. Graham Yallop got a few, I think, but again, you thought maybe the batsman might hang in there. I think Martin Kent was playing his first game as well from Queensland. Super, as he was called. Clark Kent, Martin Kent. And I think he got a 40. They'd try to bolster the batting a little bit after Headingley. That's why he got a game.
Ashes to Ashes. Edgbaston 1981 with John Embury and Terry Alderman.
England secured a couple of early wickets before Graham Yallop and Alan Border built up a partnership to take Australia's total beyond 80. Brearley asked Botham to bowl, but Headingley's star didn't fancy his chances. Shortly after, Embury took his second wicket by bowling to Yallop, who was caught by Botham.
It was that point then Ian just turned around and said, right, give me the ball. And I thought, well, I've got the two key wickets here. I've got 37 not out in England's second innings to get the score, or Australia requiring 151. I was thinking, actually, I've got a good chance of being man of the match here. And that was my thoughts at the time. If I continue to bowl and bowl well, that was going to be the case. And, of course, Ian then got his sort of blood got going, and all of a sudden he started to run in harder. He bowled, and although it wasn't a quick pitch, he hit the pitch hard. And he bowled full, and he bowled straight. And all of a sudden, he got a breakthrough, and then another breakthrough, and then another breakthrough. And as this was happening, the players were becoming euphoric on the field, that all of a sudden we felt, we are going to win this game. And Ian picked up those three wickets. And there's me still at the other end trying to get wickets as well to win the game. But then Ian came on and got the last two wickets as well. And I didn't realise that he'd actually bowled five overs and got 5 for 1, which was an incredible performance. And all of a sudden it sort of lifted Ian to hero status again.
I just remember, you know, the ball hadn't really swung a lot throughout the whole game up until that time. I don't think anyone had scored any huge amount of runs. So it was that sort of a wicket. It was just holding a little bit. It was spinning. There might have been a little bit of swing early with a new ball for me. But for late in that innings, for Beefy to come in and take that 5 to roll us, it was just the icing that England were looking for just to finish it off. But I think it was just genuine swing that he was getting. Maybe the breeze had changed or whatever. But I do remember him bowling those big in-swingers to the right-hander, and certainly for a number 11 batsman like myself, for him to get one, you know, in a Yorker length, cleaning up middle stump, it was always going to be too much for me.
Alderman facing. And that's it this time. He's made sure he's taken 5 wickets, he grabs a stump, and another memorable victory for England. Tremendous performances. Australia finally dismissed on this fourth day of this fourth test for 121.
I've never been in England with a crowd that was getting so excited and could sense that something special was going to happen, as it did at Headingley. And as these wickets were tumbling, the crowd were just going absolutely berserk. It was noisy. You couldn't even speak to the person next door to you at slip. You had to shout to him for him to hear you. But the crowd buoyed the players up as well as Ian was running in. And all of a sudden you were getting, you know, really agitated is not the word, but you had a sense of that you were going to win the game, and you were becoming euphoric yourself. And I think the crowd took us along to a certain extent. And to me, that Sunday of that Edgbaston test was probably one that will live with me forever, because I haven't experienced that before in England in a test match.
Yeah, that noise, it was just a din. You don't hear any individual things being spoken, or I didn't anyway. I think I'll never forget that. It was pretty traumatic, really, when you think about it, especially when you're the last batsman to go in. And you know, I wasn't a great watcher of the game, and I might have been putting the pads on, and you heard that roar. It was like a bullfighting ring, because where that dressing room used to be under the stand there, it was almost as though the stand was rumbling with the spectators going crazy. And the roar, you knew it wasn't going to be an umpire's decision. It was, you know, he was out.
Australia had crumbled from 105 for four to 121 all out. From the brink of defeat, England had once more snatched victory, winning by 29 runs.
Well, I remember Ian running through when he got the last wicket, and as he ran through, just picking up one of the stumps and waving it in the air. He was running towards the pavilion and all of us trying to catch him. Everyone was jumping up and everyone was sort of slapping each other on the back. And we got together as a group, slapping each other on the back, and you could hear the crowd screaming and yelling and giving their support to the team. And then you sort of gradually walked off to the dressing room, everyone with a smile on their face. The Australians, obviously very despondent, especially the last two batsmen that have got to walk off the field. A lot of us stayed in the dressing room for quite some time after the game and just sat there in bewilderment that, you know, you turn this game around from a situation that you could have lost into a win. And it was the first time I'd really experienced that on the cricket field because I wasn't part of Headingley. But you were part of the Edgbaston game. You felt really, really special.
I think there was plenty of champagne all over the place, but not in our dressing room. I think it was everywhere but in our dressing room. And I think we tried to pack our kit bags up and quietly just get out of there because the noise was just going on and on. I don't think anyone wanted to leave. I think we might have... Someone might have had a little a music box going and we tried to crank that up to drown out the cheers and, you know, 15,000 or 18,000 people there. None of them had moved, I think, an hour and a half or 2 hours after the game.
After another stellar performance at Old Trafford and a draw at the Oval, England won the series 3-1 to retain the Ashes. Despite the loss, Alderman's test career had started with 42 wickets across the series.
Well, I think Dennis Lilly took 39 at the other end. I think between us, we had over 80 wickets between the two of us, and we still lost the series 3-1 or whatever it was. So I'm flabbergasted when I see those stats. But I suppose you think maybe I could have done better. Maybe if we'd got an extra wicket or, you know, forget those three wickets there, I'd rather have had that wicket there or whatever. But... No, to do as well as I did was great, but you know, I think that was overawed by the fact that we'd lost the series.
We edged that series. Obviously, the 81 series was very special for those players that played at that time, and I think for the people in the country because of what was happening in the country at the time with the riots. And all of a sudden, you know, the riots in the newspapers and on the news took second billing. Cricket had taken over, and it seemed to lift everyone out of this gloom. And that was a special feeling as well for everyone, that sport could actually do that. And being part of that was something really special. Ian, to a certain extent, is a talisman in the way that he played his cricket. He played his cricket in a way that no others did. He played with a freedom, he played with abandon. And he played in such a way that you wished you played your cricket in the same way. And you would like to have that same hero status as Ian, but the way you were brought up dictates to a certain extent the way that you're going to develop as an individual. Ian had that in him from a very, very young age. I didn't. But being part of a team with Ian Botham in it was fun, enjoyable, and again, very special.
With thanks to Paul Hayward and Sheil Berry. Ashes to Ashes is produced by Kate Borsay. As soon as they're released, the other episodes in this five-part series will be available on iTunes, where you can leave us a review or go to telegraph.co.uk. Ashes to Ashes is a production by The Telegraph.